Good morning, everyone. My name is Elaine Harris, and I'm a proud member of this congregation for over 20 years. And we have a very lovely tradition in this church of an open pulpit. So members of the congregation are invited to come along and give service from time to time. And this is my turn today. The usual health warning, everything I say here today is something that resonates with me. If it resonates with you, that's fantastic. If it doesn't, that's also fantastic. But please consider, if it doesn't resonate with you, we would love to hear your opinion on things as well. So for my opening words today, mindful that we've probably all broken our New Year's resolutions already, I use the words of Lois Van Leer, a former minister from Eugene, Oregon. Let go. Let go of all that binds you, of all that burdens you, of what you carry, of all that shames you, of fear, of trespasses and transgressions, of woundedness. Let go of guilt. Let go of anger. Let go of small-mindedness and pettiness, of ways of being that no longer work for you, of compulsions that consume your living. Let go of what you cannot change. Let go of regret. Let go of regret of what haunts you. Let go of pain. Let go of ways in which you missed the mark. Let go. So for our chalice lighting, I have chosen the following words. In the mystery of life about us, there is light. It gives us a place to be, a place to grow, a place to rejoice together. It opens the pathways to love. In this place of friendship, there is freedom. Let the light we kindle go before us, strong in hope, wide in goodwill, inviting the day to come. And our first hymn this morning is number 12, O Life That Maketh All Things New. And our first reader this morning is Alison.
Morning, everybody. I'm going to take you back out onto the Bull Wall this morning. At the end of the Bull Wall in Dublin Bay stands the iconic statue of Mary, Mother of Jesus, known as Réilt na Mara in Irish, or in English, Star of the Sea, an epithet she shares with other female divinities, such as Isis, Ishtar, Aphrodite, and Venus. Mary stands on a globe atop three pillars rising 70 feet into the air. She faces inland with her arms outstretched in a blessing to all sea voyagers leaving Dublin Port. It was the marine port and docker workers who paid for the statue, which was erected in 1972. There are two benches at the foot of her statue, and they too face inland. I like to sit there and take Mary down from her pedestal and reclaim her as an ordinary woman, a mother, a parent, a sister, a friend, and a neighbour. Like so many people, she knew the pain and anguish of saying goodbye to a loved one as they set out from home in the hope of creating a better life and world. I usually have my headphones on listening to music, and there's one song that I like to play from my playlist as I sit with Mary and I think of all the peoples of the world who have left their homelands for whatever reason, be it economic, social, religious, or because of war and politics. It's the song Somewhere from the Leonard Bernstein musical West Side Story, where the two star-crossed lovers of immigrants, Maria and Tony, find each other and express their hopes for finding a place for them in the world. I won't sing it because that'll make you all want to emigrate. So with Mary's blessing, I'll read the beautiful love poem. Somewhere. somewhere. There's a place for us somewhere, a place for us. Peace and quiet and open air wait for us somewhere. There's a time for us, someday a time for us. Time together and time to spare. Time to learn, time to care. Someday, somewhere, we'll find a new way of living. We'll find a way of forgiving somewhere. There's a place for us, a time and place for us. Hold my hand and we're halfway there. Hold my hand and I'll take you there. Somehow, someday, somewhere.
I invite you to join with me in reading the doctrine of our church. It's on the end page of our book. Love is the doctrine of this church. The quest of truth is its sacrament, and service is its prayer. To dwell together in peace, to seek knowledge and freedom, to serve mankind in fellowship, to the end that all souls shall grow in harmony with the divine. This do we covenant with each other and with God. Amen. For my reading, I'm going to read a Seamus Heaney poem called St. Kevin and the Blackbird. It's based on a legend of how St. Kevin, praying in his cell in Glendalough, had his hand outstretched while he was praying, and it was such a small cell that one of his hands was outside the cell, and a blackbird landed on it. And while she landed on it, she laid her eggs on his hand. And according to the story, Kevin was filled with compassion and decided to stay in this position until the eggs hatched. I chose this poem for a number of reasons. It's one of the poems I first heard in Heaney's own voice, and it had such a contemplative and comforting tone that I use it as one of my meditation pieces in my Metta-Bhavana practice. And I've always felt a link to St. Kevin. His feast day is my birthday. And some of my earliest and happiest memories are picnics with my family down in Glendalough. And finally, recently, I've just completed a degree in archaeology. And I've had the privilege to spend a couple of weeks each year for the past couple of years down digging in, doing excavations in the monastery complex in Glendalough. So it's a very circular relationship, my relationship with Kevin. And I think this poem is beautiful. Saint Kevin and the Blackbird. And then there was Saint Kevin and the Blackbird. The saint is kneeling, arms stretched out, inside his cell, but the cell is narrow. So one upturned palm is out the window, stiff as a crossbeam, when a blackbird lands and lays in it, and settles down to nest. Kevin feels the warm eggs, the small breast, the tucked neat head and claws, and finding himself linked into the network of eternal life is moved to pity. Now he must hold his hand like a branch out in the sun and rain for weeks until the young are hatched and fledged and flown. And since the whole thing's imagined anyhow, imagine being Kevin. Which is he? Self-forgetful or in agony all the time? From the neck on out down through his hurting forearms, are his fingers sleeping? Does he still feel his knees? Or has the shut eye blank of the under-earth crept up through him? Is there distance in his head? Alone and mirrored, clear in love's deep river, to labor and not to seek reward he prays. A prayer his body makes entirely, for he has forgotten self, forgotten bird, and on the riverbank forgotten the river's name. So for our children's story today, Michael's going to read a poem.
It's a bit circular, considering we started with the bull wall. Jump in your canoe, go out, turn north, go around Holt, go all the way up Malahide, go in there to the estuary. I grew up there, over and done a bait. We were inland about 2 miles in the village, but I spent my time and summers down by the estuary. Not the beach. The beach was just waves, tide coming in and coming out. But the estuary, when you turned inside, that's different. It's ephemeral. It's neither land or sea. Depending on the stage of the tide, the land disappears, the sea disappears, the water. It's all different, the smells, the touch, all of it. And I only learned later on, one of my favourite poets lived out across the road in Malahide, Pat Inglesby. So this is Pat doing what most kids can do. The sea would come creeping over flat sand, a beautiful, slow conspiracy of silent water, inching around stones, wandering under weed, meandering this way and that. We would be watching the edges of it, a whole sea together, coming slowly in, near and near and near, right up to the village green, right up to where it came the last time and the time before, right up to the line it marked across the stone, making it wet again.
So for hymn number 2, we're going to sing number 58, Ring Out the Wild Bells. As we come into reflection, I'm going to read a few words of Marcus, from Marcus Aurelius, and our pause will be brought to an end by an anthem from the choir. So to bring us into these few moments of silence and reflection, I'd like you to consider the words of Marcus Aurelius. Life is a pilgrimage and a struggle. All we have of time is a moment. The universe is in constant flux. Our bodies are fragile. Our senses grasp so little. Our souls are a mist. The future is a fog. And fame is fleeting. was lovely. So my address today is looking at the concept of pilgrimages. It looks at examples from different belief systems and contemplates why people were and are inspired to undertake them. And finally, it asks if there is still a role for pilgrimages in my life and hopefully your lives as well. The service was prompted by the book A Travel Guide to the Middle Ages by Anthony Bale. It's a book that explores the whys and wheres of travel in the Middle Ages, focusing on those who choose to engage in pilgrimages. Now, pilgrimages in the Middle Ages were not for the faint-hearted and carried a serious risk to life and limb. There was a reasonable expectation that you would not return from whatever land you were setting off for. These pilgrimages were carried out for many reasons, including to fulfill a ritual obligation or to perform an act of devotion or to atone for one's sins or even to ask for a particular favor. Of particular interest to medieval travelers was obtaining indulgences or pardons. And these were ways of reducing your amount of time in purgatory. These indulgences were usually associated with travel to a saint's shrine, and the pilgrims would pay that particular church or its brokers for certificates of indulgences. So I'm going to give you an example of some of the indulgences that you could obtain in the 13 or 1400s should you have traveled to Rome. So should you have traveled to Rome and landed up in St. Peter's in the Vatican, you got 28 years at each of the 28 altars on the relevant saint's day, plus 7 years at the 7 most important altars. You got 1,000 years of remission of purgatory on the Feast of the Annunciation, 1,000 years on Maundy Thursday, 1,000 years on St. Peter's Feast Day, 7,000 years and remission from a third of all sins on the anniversary of the church's dedication. When the vernacle, which is the cloth of St. Veronica, is shown, you got 3,000 years if you were a Roman, 9,000 years if you had traveled from between the Alps and Rome, and 12,000 years for those who had come from beyond the Alps. If you went to St. John Lateran's Church, you got full remission of sins for all those who entered the chapel of St. John the Baptist, men only. Women could get the indulgences if they touched the door. In St. Lawrence's Outside the Walls, you got 7 years of pardon, 7 Lents, and remission of a third of all sins, 100 years on the feast days of St. Lawrence and St. Stephen, and anyone who visited the church on a Wednesday could deliver a soul from purgatory. With our 21st century sensibilities, it's easy to scoff at this and even to fail to understand what might have prompted people to give up everything and take off for sometimes years at a time to go to far off places, often with little chance of returning. But are we doing those who engaged in these pilgrimages and even ourselves a disservice by not taking some time to explore why people chose and still choose to go on pilgrimages? I suppose, like many of you who grew up in Ireland, the first thing that comes to mind when I think of pilgrimages is particularly Catholic-centric. Places like Lourdes, Knock, and Lough Derg spring to mind, alongside traditional pilgrimage routes like the Camino de Compostela and the Reek Sunday to climb Crowpatrick. I think the idea of pilgrimages was something that was just something I grew up with. When I was little, everybody I knew had bottles of holy water from Knock or Lourdes. And as I got older and my world became a little wider, I met people from other countries and discovered that pilgrimages are a part of many cultures and religious traditions. And I learned about pilgrimages like the Umrah to Mecca and the Hindu festival of Kumbh Mela. Accustomed to stories of Knock and Lourdes and even Medjugorje, pilgrimages to Mecca or holy cities in Uttar Pradesh seemed utterly romantic. as did the more secular ones that I'd heard about, like the Burning Man Festival in Glastonbury. But we weren't an overtly religious family, so trips to Lourdes and Knock were not for me. And although I did manage the odd trip to Tip, Glastonbury and the Burning Man Festival were beyond my reach, and if I was being entirely honest, probably beyond my understanding. Living in a field for a week with questionable hygiene standards and awful foods was just not my thing. Anyway, back to medieval pilgrimages. Reading the book, this one here, The Traveller's Guide to Middle Ages, really gave me pause. Why would people, rich and poor alike, decide to leave everything behind and head off on these pilgrimages? Remember, this was when it wasn't an easy thing to consider doing. There was no cheap Ryanair flights, no nice package trips that could drop you into Rome or Jerusalem for a quick trip to the Basilica, you know, to visit the relevant relics, and then a quick trip to duty-free on the way home. These trips could take several years. They were to far-flung lands filled with strange people who spoke different languages, ate different foods, and had entirely different customs. The trip across Europe would have involved navigating hundreds of fiefdoms, baronies, principalities, and kingdoms where there were taxes and tolls and bribes to be paid. There were no handy reviews on TripAdvisor, no Google Maps, no Revolut app to pay for food and lodgings. So what made people do this? I had a look at the Bible to see if I could find any explanations. And indeed, there are many, many examples in both the Old and New Testament that talk of journeys undertaken that I suppose we could consider pilgrimages. In Genesis, Abraham leaves his home to go in search of God, to go in search of a land which God promises to show him, becoming a pilgrim or a sojourner, whose willingness to obey God makes him a model of faith and obedience. The story of Moses leading his people on the exodus from Egypt is one that plays a key role in Christian thought. And the long journey through the wilderness towards the promised land has been interpreted as a paradigm of the Christian journey through a fallen world towards heaven. In the New Testament, Christians are encouraged to see themselves as pilgrims and strangers on the earth, as temporary residents whose true home is in heaven. Both John and Mark describe Christian life as a journey towards that homeland in which the individual believer seeks to follow and obey Christ through an alien, frequently hostile world. So, being a Unitarian, I looked at other faith systems and belief systems too, and I found that in Hinduism, the pilgrimage is viewed as a liminal process that establishes participation in the spiritual realm. It is also undertaken as a social duty, a rite of passage, and a mode of supplication. Pilgrims are expected to engage with the sacred landscapes they encounter on the way. And these landscapes are partly defined by sacred symbols, cosmographic and astrological alignments, traditions, festivals, and the belief that these places themselves are spiritual crossing places into the transcendent realms of the divine. Hindu holy sites can be classified into three particular groups. Water sites, usually associated with sacred immersion on auspicious occasions. Shrines dedicated to particular deities, which are visited by pilgrims of particular sects or with particular needs. And kshetra, sacred lands usually defined by a cosmic mandala, traveling along which brings special merit. I'm sure many of you can see resonances and similarities between these concepts and some of our traditional places of pilgrimage too. Places where we had festivals like Imbolag and Samhain, which aligned with particular astrological events. Places like Newgrange and Knowth and Knock Row, where we have evidence of the importance to the people of the time of gathering together at the winter solstice. And we know that through the millennia, particular springs and wells were viewed as sacred held spaces where cures could be had. These places have had a special resonance for our people, And as our beliefs changed, so too did the way we viewed these sites. And instead of being associated with more ancient forms of spirituality, they were just adapted and adopted into current belief structures. But their importance remained deep in our tacit knowledge. In Judaism, pilgrimages are defined as a journey made to a shrine or sacred place in performance of a vow or for the sake of obtaining some form of divine blessing. Every male Israelite was required to visit the temple in Jerusalem 3 times a year at Sukkot, Pesach, and Shavuot. The Hajj is an annual pilgrimage to Mecca and is one of the 5 pillars of Islam. It's a mandatory religious duty for capable Muslims that must be carried out at least once in their lifetime by all adult Muslims who are physically and financially capable of undertaking the journey, providing that they can support their family during their absence from home. So I think we can see that many faiths and traditions share the idea of sacred sites that believers want to journey to. And I think these pilgrims can be viewed as pilgrimages can be viewed as an allegory of human life on earth. I think a pilgrimage can be viewed as the exteriorization of an inner journey towards truth, or maybe just an adventure in spiritual discovery. All pilgrimages can have both a physical and metaphorical component to them. And indeed, the concept of the importance of the metaphorical aspects of pilgrimages was one that has found expression through art and poetry and song over the millennia. When researching for this address, I came across this tiny anonymous poem ascribed to the Irish tradition that speaks to this aspect, and I really like it. Who to Rome goes, much labor, little profit knows. For God, on earth though long you sought him, you'll miss in Rome unless you brought him. For those who could not or would not make arduous physical pilgrimages, there were other options too. If you were very rich, you could pay someone else to do it for you. Plus a changer. But the other option was the labyrinth. And the history of the labyrinth is fascinating. It dates back thousands of years. There is evidence on drawings in Russia of it dating back to early Bronze Age. Prehistoric labyrinths, people suggest, may have served as traps for malevolent spirits or as paths for ritual dances, but we really don't know. It has been suggested, though, in medieval times, and we do have some record for this, that when people were unable to undertake a physical pilgrimage, they could walk the labyrinth as their sacred path, and many chose to do so. We have examples of labyrinths all around Europe. Pilgrims and monks have been depicted in art to walk labyrinths on their knees to humble themselves before the divine. The labyrinth can be viewed as a sacred ancient path and has been a spiritual resource used by pilgrims for centuries. Indeed, there are many examples in the Christian tradition of repetitive enclosed paths at sacred sites, which may even have pre-Christian origins. So, having explored some of the historical aspects of pilgrimages, I then turned to thinking about what the idea might mean to me, or if the concept had any relevance in the way I choose to live. And unsurprisingly, I found it did. If you remember when I was introducing the reading I had earlier on, I spoke about the affinity I've always had with St. Kevin. From happy picnics in Glendalough as a child to carrying out archaeological excavations there. I love this symmetry. It rests well with my personal worldview. I think there are resonances from across time and space that speak to you if you listen carefully enough. And like the words of Tennyson in Splendor's Falls, "Oh hark, oh hear, how thin and clear, and thinner, clearer, farther growing. O sweet and far from cliff and scar, the horns of Elfland faintly blowing. Blow, let us hear the purple glens replying. Blow, bugles answer echoes dying, dying, dying. O love, they die in yon rich sky. They faint on hill or field or river. Our echoes roll from soul to soul and grow forever and forever. Blow, bugle, blow, and set the wild echoes flying. Answer, echoes, answer. Dying, dying, dying. I try to listen out for those echoes, and I'm not sure if they are ancient wisdom or aspects of a supernatural power, but when I get a sense of them, I embrace them. And for me, these fleeting echoes can sometimes be a place or a particular time of the year, like the solstice. But when they happen, for the tiniest of seconds, I get a sense of the vastness of this world and the smallness of my life. But in that smallness, there is a connection to every other being, and that is as it should be. So my pilgrimages are and will continue to be both physical and metaphorical. We only have this one tiny life to lead, and journeying to find that glimpse of that connection will keep pushing me onward. So to finish, I'd like to read you the last few paragraphs of the book that describe the final days of Oderic of Pordenone, an Italian Franciscan friar and missionary explorer who traveled through India, Sumatra, Java, and China, and who died in 1331 after returning from 10 years of traveling. Oderic's story bears out the idea that at the end of our exploring, we arrive where we started, but we understand that starting point anew. On returning from their journey, the traveller is somehow changed, wise in new ways, having encountered radical differences and wonderful similarities, their home life and prior knowledge thrown into a new relief. Travel forces us to consider the significance of our lives and to encounter the littleness of the human amid the planet's variety and unknowability. As he struggled homewards, the dying Oderic may well have felt that the earth he had traversed had itself become tiny, nothing more than a series of points on a small surface, and that the time had come to turn from earthly things to the celestial. This was not to cease roaming, but to search instead for yet other worlds. As the sun set and the blue deepened into night, Oderic received his passport into the skies to join those released from their bodies and from earthly travels into the brilliant circles amid the blazing stars where the soul would begin its mysterious, incorporeal journey towards the horizon of infinity. I hope with this address I've given you something to think about. Hopefully it may have inspired you to think of pilgrimages, physical or metaphorical, that will help you on your paths. Namaste. And now we will have hymn number 205, Amazing Grace. So our notices. There is a meeting of the Damer and Singleton Committee downstairs in the vestry after the service. Tea and coffee is served downstairs after the service. We would love to see you downstairs, please. There are copies of January's Auscult on the table outside and also copies of the Unitarian and Inspiration. On Wednesday, there's a lunchtime meditation service available in the church and on the web camera. And the book club will take place on the 29th of January in the vestry at 7:30, and all are welcome. This month's books are Hotel du Lac by Anita Bruckner and Butter by Asako Yuzuki. And Josh asked me to mention as well that the choir are always looking for additional members. As you can tell, they have beautiful arrangements and it really adds to the service here. So if anyone feels that they would like to join as well, they are more than welcome. Please see Shari or Josh. It only remains for me to say thank you to everybody that helped get ready for the service today. I really appreciate all the help involved in getting here and getting a service running. Thanks to those that greet people, thanks to those that get the church ready, and thanks for those that are going to do the coffee and tea afterwards. And thank you for the opportunity to do the service today. I really enjoyed it. I didn't expect to. The final hymn is hymn 106, Who Would True Valor See? Our closing words are from the American UU website by somebody called Susan Magan. We Unitarian Universalists are a people of the wandering pilgrimage. We wander in ways of love as best we know them today, wandering in wholeness, healing, and transformation, becoming our deepest, truest selves, together knowing we will stumble along the way and we will restore one another. Whether or not we ever plan on a grand trip to faraway lands, why not live each day as if we are all on a wandering pilgrimage right now? Because we are. Any day can be a day of relishing the triumphs of the soul, and our greatest pilgrimage sites might just be closer than we think. Amen.